My name is Pete and I am an alcoholic. Could we open this meeting with a moment of silent meditation and gratitude for the AA recoveries of the past 70 years, followed by the Serenity Prayer? God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Several years ago, I heard a tape by a speaker, and he said, if you really want to mess with an old timer, ask them how you turn it over. He said, they'll always tell you, just turn it over. But ask them how you do that, and then they'll start to stutter. So today, you're going to have the privilege of hearing three old-timers explain to you how they turn it over. And keeping with policy, ladies first, we will start with Leslie from Torrington, Connecticut, who has 24 years.
My name is Leslie, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm a nervous wreck, but I've always heard that if you're not nervous when you speak, I've heard it's a lie, you're not going to do well, so I'm going to do fabulously because I'm shaking like a leaf. But anyway, the other thing is I have to explain to you that a couple of years ago I had brain surgery. I kid around a lot, and sometimes people thought I was a little nutty. So now they go like, oh, no wonder, you know. But I like to kid around. Okay, so I'm going to qualify briefly, and I might use these glasses if I can figure out whether I need them or not. Oh, this is awful. Oh, I drank daily for 20 years. I got drunk every night. I passed out frequently. I called it going to bed early. Unfortunately, it was quite often on the couch. But anyway, I should have said going to the couch early instead of the bed, but anyway. And I didn't get into too much trouble until I left my first husband. Then I had three car accidents. One, I flipped the car, but, you know, I rationalized and denied it. You know, it was a dark and rainy night, and, you know, whatever. The thing was, and I hardly had anything to drink because once when I left my husband, I was scared to drive, you know. But, you know, I only had three or four beers, and so I didn't think that was that much. And but anyway, you know how you just, when you're not ready to think you have a problem with alcohol, it's everything and anything but. I wasn't exactly sure how to do this, so I just did it the way I thought I should. And I was just going to tell you my absolute worst of, I just had so many bad drunk experiences, but I wanted to tell you about my very worst one. I passed out, woke up at the sound of my own voice screaming at the top of my lungs, hearing a loud knocking at the door of this motel room I found myself in alone, and my boyfriend had left me there, and I opened the door, and I saw two state troopers. This was up in I think it's up in Vermont. They look like Sergeant Preston of the Yukon. You know, they had these outfits on. And I'm screaming, I'll be quiet, I'll be quiet. I still remember this, believe it or not. It was so many years ago. And then they left, and I passed back out again, and no more screaming. And I had the worst hangover I used to have hangovers every single morning. But this was the all-time worst. I remember going to the store and getting some Alka-Seltzer, because I always heard that Alka-Seltzer would help with that. And then I'd make myself one, and I'd gulp it down, and then I'd wait, nothing, and I used to have another thing. I just thought of this. I used to iron a lot, because that would kind of, you know, the next day, that would get you to sweat it out. No, seriously, I had all these ways of dealing with hangovers. I wound up in AA by, quote-unquote, coincidence. Of course, we know there's no such thing as coincidence. I wanted to drink for the first 3 years that I was in the program, but I didn't, because people at the meetings that I would go to seemed to understand how life worked and be okay with it, and I didn't. And I really didn't have bad parents or anything. I mean, I just didn't understand how it worked. So I kept going to meetings. I tried to follow the suggestions to the best of my ability, and I just didn't drink a day at a time. And I wanted to drink, but then I thought, like, but I wanted to get past the wanting to drink to the good stuff, you know, to learning how to live. So anyway, okay. Now I'm just going to wing this because I added this. I was going to say how a funny thing about when I had a, I don't think it was even a year in the program. I went to speak at Sing Sing. I'm from New York, and if you don't know what Sing Sing is, it's this humongous prison on the Hudson, and I got in there and I heard this, you know, door that was about this wide, creak shut, and there I was. And I have a little bit of claustrophobia anyway. So then I get to this meeting that, you know, there was a leader and two speakers, and I was one, and then there was a man. And I forgot that it was just a man's prison, so I go into this room, and they undressed me. Now, remember, this was almost 25 years ago. I looked a lot fuller. Anyway, they hadn't seen a woman in a long time, so it didn't matter, you know. So they, you know, I was totally undressed with their eyes, you know. And then I shared, and it was so cute because they stole a cake to serve at halftime. It was so cute, you know. But you know what? I'm very claustrophobic. I don't go to prisons anymore for that reason. You know, it's one of those things I said, you know, if I ever get out of here alive, I'm never going to do this again. But anyway. Okay, well, now I think, where am I here? I'm back to my notes. Oh, okay. In the past, I drank when I was happy, sad, bored, lonely, angry, etc. It was a handy-dandy, all-purpose answer to all of life's situations. After about 3 years in the program, as I said, I wanted to drink for those whole 3 years, but I just wanted to get to the good stuff. I just wanted to feel okay, you know. And everybody, I think I'm skipping ahead, but anyway, everybody seemed to understand how life worked, as I said, and I just wanted to be able to do that. So after about 3 years, I had some tools. I am a very slow learner. So I had some tools to think about and to use, and I had friends. I had real friends, not the kind that, you know, when you had money or something, they were your friend, or, you know, you could do something for them. Anyway, when my first sponsor said that it was time for me to do the third step, I was afraid to turn everything over to the higher power because he might not do it the way I knew it had to be done. But my life was such a mess, I didn't really have anything to lose. Of course, I took it back immediately, but it was a start, you know. And this is hard to believe. I can't even believe this myself. It took me about 15 years. I am a very, very slow learner. I finally started to turn stuff over, you know, and let it go. But I didn't have any peace of mind. I still would worry and stuff. I would kind of let it go and wait and see. But I didn't really have peace of mind. And this past year, and I'm pushing 24 years. My anniversary is the 29th of this month. I finally started to let it go, to turn it over and to let it go, mostly, pretty much. I mean, I'd be lying. Well, you know, the reality is I'm a warrior. That's how I am, you know. But I'm doing a lot better for me. You know, everybody used to talk about page 449 in the big book. Well, by the time I read it and really meant it, I mean, just even read it and listened and concentrated on it, it's now page 417. That's all right. It's okay. Because it's a lifetime program. They must have talked about it being a lifetime program when they knew I was going to be around. I must have been working on other things. You know, I worked on a lot of stuff, but not these things. But anyway. Yeah, here's what I put. I'd say yes, but never really had a clue about what it meant or wondered about doing legwork. When I finally started to read it, of course, there was a meeting that I go to all the time that they read it at the end of the meeting, but, you know, again, whatever, I wasn't ready. I was working on other things. So then I really read it, and I thought, but it doesn't say anything about doing the legwork and letting the outcome up to the higher power. So one day, I actually read the whole chapter, and the last two paragraphs in that chapter, and then it all fell into place. Basically it says, do the legwork and let the outcome up to the higher power. And I do have to, as you probably can guess, serenity was never one of my strong suits. Anyway, I don't know how long I talked. I'm winding up now, and I have to tell you this, because see, I think I'm hysterical. No, there goes the last of my humility. But the thing is that. Really, I do it for myself. I laugh at myself. And if anybody else thinks it's funny, well, I'm glad. My mother used to say, what are you, the class clown? She wanted me to be lovely, and I was just never lovely. I was the class clown. But anyway, I want to say that thank God for the program. The drinking was the least of my problems. It was my thinking. But until I got beyond the drinking, sorry, but until I got beyond the drinking and wanting to drink, beyond drinking and wanting to drink, I couldn't work on my thinking. All these years later, the slogans, the precepts, etc., and all the wonderful friends I have, my sponsor, my pigeons, yes, pigeons. That's what they were called when I came in. I've been at meetings where people get very offended if you call your sponsees pigeons to them. But because thanks to all of them and my higher power, I get through each day, good, bad, or just plain okay, one day at a time. And thank you so much.
I heard they had a whole meeting about that in New York. It was kind of a slow day, and they were trying to decide what to do, and somebody said, well, Leslie just found page 449. Let's switch it. Wrote a whole new book for you. If you're a newcomer in this room now, you know there's hope for you. Hi, Tracy. Next, Henry from St. Petersburg, Florida, with 35 years.
Good afternoon. My name is Henry, and I am a very grateful recovering alcoholic. My sobriety date is April 22nd, 1970. And I don't know how you feel about that, but I got to tell you, it impresses the hell out of me. I'm not as funny as Leslie. I came to AA as part of a con to save a marriage. And I lived on Long Island and had an office on Madison Avenue in New York and traveled a great deal. And we had boats and cars and expense accounts and all that stuff. And, of course, a lot to drink. I was one of the pioneers of the three martini lunch that Ronald Reagan used to talk about. And from time to time, my then wife would talk about my drinking, and to which, and I was drinking, at the end I was drinking for a long time, about a quarter a day. And I would say, well, do you think I ought to go to AA? And she'd say, well, we were drinking buddies. And she would say, well, you're not that bad. Well, everybody here knows that's a license, okay? But I was really serious about saving the marriage. There were three kids, 10, 11, and 12. And we would have these quarterly discussions about I'm not that bad. And so I made a commitment. I came in April, as I said, the previous November, to have only two drinks a day. And I kept it. November, Thanksgiving, Christmas, New Year's, all the way through St. Patrick's Day and everything, to the middle of April, and nothing changed. If nothing changes, nothing changes, and that's precisely what happened. I didn't realize it at the time, but I was doing two things. One of them was I was weaning myself off of alcohol, and the other thing was that I was turning it over. And so I'm also a workaholic, like so many of us, and I was in my office one morning about 7 o'clock, and pondering this situation, and all of a sudden it struck me, instead of talking about going to AA, why don't you just go to AA? And so I called up and found out, and they said, you're in luck, they asked where I live, and there's a meeting, a beginner's meeting near your home, and we'll pick you up. And I said, well, that's not necessary, I can get there. And I went. And it was incredible in looking back, because that, in essence, was also turning it over, but I didn't realize it at the time. I was blessed because I didn't have any big withdrawal problems that so many of us have experienced because of what I had done the previous 6 months or so. I went to beginner's meeting. It was in a small classroom in a church building in Oyster Bay, Long Island. There were 17 or 18 people there. About a third of them were women. And there were two other guys besides me that were in their very first AA meeting ever. And so there were three of us. And they said all the things that we say in beginner's meetings. We do it one day at a time and make 90 meetings in 90 days and find a home group and get a sponsor and all that sort of thing. And I heard it. And the other two guys didn't hear it, because 1 year later they were both dead from alcoholism. And that, I had absolutely nothing to do with that. I mean, that just happened. The fact that I went was a surrender. The fact that I listened, the fact that when I walked in that room, I knew I was home. The fact that I was thirsty for what I heard. The fact that I was amazed at what I saw and I wanted some of what I saw was all a gift, an incredible, awesome, unbelievable gift. And I feel, 1 year later when those guys were dead and I went to those funerals, I came to really realize the dimension of this awesome, incredible, unbelievable gift. And I feel that for that, I have a lifetime mortgage. And I'm here today making a mortgage payment. I started doing, tried to do everything that they said. I'm sure I didn't, but I tried to, because I wanted what I saw. And so at the end of the beginner's meeting, there was a regular meeting. And I must have passed the test because I was invited to go to the regular meeting. And at the end of the meeting, they said, again, 90 meetings, 90 days. And I said, where's tomorrow? And they said, well, it's in Syosset. And so I went. And at the end of that meeting, I said, where's tomorrow? And they said, well, it's in Cold Spring, but it's an open-ended meeting and it's sort of advanced. It's really not a very good idea for a beginner to go to, because you might be confused. So I went. And it became one of my favorite meetings for a lot of years. They told me about getting a home group and a sponsor, and I picked a home group, and I looked around and picked out somebody and asked him to be my sponsor, and he turned me down. And I had been to just enough meetings and heard just enough to know somehow to use the tools that seemed to be available to not get drunk over that, not get a resentment over rejection and all that stuff. And so I looked around, took me another 3 or 4 weeks, and I found somebody else, and I asked him, and he turned me down. And once again, I had heard enough and knew where the tools were and how to deal with all of that. And I looked around some more, and then a couple of weeks later, a man and his wife returned from this honeymoon, and there was a Sunday night meeting, and they were just coming from Kennedy Airport, and the speakers didn't show up, and he spoke, and he told my story. The first guy, I later found out that the first fellow that I asked was sober 6 months, and he asked his sponsor about that, and his sponsor said he thought he was a little young for that, and that's the reason he turned me down, and we remained good friends for a long time. The second guy clearly knew that he was going out, and he did, and I don't know whatever happened to him. So all this stuff, you know, goes on, and it's some kind of a something out there that makes it all happen. And the recognition of that, in my mind, is a turn it over. So I went to work. Now I had a sponsor, and I started, you know, they were after me to do the steps and so forth. And I don't drink coffee. I don't like coffee. I don't like the smell of coffee. I don't like the looks of it. I don't like the taste of it. I know it's a dirty drink and all that stuff. And so they said one day to me, "Congratulations, you've been elected the coffee maker." I said, "You don't understand, quack, quack, quack." And they said, "Well, normally we only let people have that job for 3 months, but you're an advanced case, so you'll get it for 6 months." And I did. I turned it over. That's how you turn it over, okay? And an interesting thing happened. There was one of the gals, women there, was an elder. Her name was Greta. She was a native of Ireland, and at the time of the story, she had 20 or some odd years of sobriety. And it was a Sunday night meeting, and it was a large group. You had to put up 100 or 125 chairs and make two of these huge urns, that wonderful beverage called coffee. And so I was there doing the chairs and making the coffee, and she came in early. And I don't even remember what the problem was, but for some reason I was very angry about a broken shoelace that day. And she, Greta, said to me, "How are you, lad?" And I told her how I was, lad. And she said, "Well, pray for the poor soul." "You've got to be kidding me." And she very patiently explained to me that if I have a resentment or a piece of anger about something, the chances are that the people or the incident or whatever has no knowledge of my discomfort. But as long as I choose to hang on to that resentment, there will be an acid drip, drip, drip in my gut. If you don't like to pray, then think well of that person. Wish well for him. And the acid drip, drip, drip will go away. There's nothing very complicated about that. And that is turning it over. As time went on, there were a lot of incidents where I began to understand the value of turning it over. One of the things was that when I was 9 years sober, they found a malignant polyp in 1979, and I had a 4 or 5 hour surgery and so forth, and obviously it worked, okay? The fascinating part of that story was that what I did at that time was I worked for a large machinery company, and I traveled nationally, and I knew a lot of people everywhere, and the surgery in the 70s was a lot different than it is today. And it required, I don't know, 3 weeks in rehab in the hospital or whatever. It was a strong period of time. And so I had the surgery, and then I was in this hospital room in the New York hospital, and I got a lot of flowers. I mean, I got tons and tons and tons of flowers. And my roommate was a Jewish guy. He was really from Coney Island. He was pedigree, okay? And he was, I would dare say, he was well into his 60s, and he was there for a hernia operation, and obviously it was painful. And he was angry about the fact that it was painful, and he didn't have any flowers. And he was the day that they had the surgery, he was scheduled to go to Palm Beach. If you're from Coney Island and you're Jewish, that's not Palm Beach, that's Palm Beach. And I said, "How are you?" And he said, "I don't have any flowers. I'm supposed to be in Palm Beach." And I was able to see firsthand how the anger was impeding his healing. And it strengthened my... I said, "By the way, you can have all the flowers, you know. There'll be more tomorrow, okay." And then about 5 or 6 years ago, an interesting thing happened. I'm also a sailor. A girl here was talking about sailing in the last meeting. And I frequently like to go sailing in the evening after a meeting. So this one particular Friday night, I'd been to a meeting and came home. I thought it was in August or something. And I thought, you know, I'm going to go sailing for a while. So I drove down to the boat, and for some reason, I changed my mind. I don't know why to this minute why, but I did. And I went home and sat down at the computer, started to do some email. I got a bad chest pain. And I waited a couple of minutes, thought it was gas, and didn't go away. So I went and laid down in the bed and waited for it to go away. It didn't, so I picked up the phone and called 911. And they came, and you know, the next day I had triple bypass and so forth. But my reaction to all that, because of the tools and all the study and all the work, was that I really don't have any control over this. And ultimately that led to an article of faith, I guess. But I came to understand that for me, all I have is the responsibility to take the next breath and the responsibility to do something about feeding and clothing and housing this body, this gift. And about the second breath after that, I don't know anything about that until we get there. And I heard an interesting thing in a meeting a couple of weeks ago. We are all faced, if we want to be honest with it, about it, either the next breath or the next life. And that's really what I had been thinking all along. And I came to realize that that's all I had, and that my responsibility simply was to take good care of me so that I, in the event that I'm given the next breath, I'm able to deal with it and do whatever's the next right thing. And that has that brought me to a clear understanding for myself of humility. And that means that I know exactly what it is that I can do by myself. And I know exactly what it is that I cannot do by myself. And that is that I can, if I'm given the next breath, I can take it. But beyond that, everything else is a gift. Everything else is a gift. The laughter, the joy, the happiness, the tools to deal with the sadness, and all the wonders of life. I'm a big, big advocate of steps. And the first step is made a decision to turn our will and our admitted we were powerless over alcohol and our lives were unmanageable. Well, that in itself is a turn it over. I heard early days that was a surrender, and the surrender was described to me this way. In the surrender, there is victory. In the victory, there is freedom. And this morning's meeting talked only about freedom. And that's really what I was after, was the freedom. But there's a hook, as there is with all freedoms, as we're finding out on the other side of the world these days. And that is responsibility. And my responsibility is to do whatever it is that I'm supposed to do, whenever it is that I'm supposed to do it, to be there. And how it all turns out is really not up to me. As long as I do the right thing, it's going to turn out the way it's supposed to going to turn out. And I really have very little to do with that. So when I looked at the first step and recognized that, in fact, I was in the right place and that I was powerless over alcohol, but I had difficulty comprehending the unmanageability part. I was married, three kids, boats, cars, Madison Avenue, travel, expense account, what's the problem? And one of the elders who's sitting in this room now suggested that I change the word life to wife because she sure as hell was unmanageable. But it broke the code for me, and I came to understand. And I think that this whole magnificent, awesome, incredible gift is a journey. It's not a destination. It's a journey. And I think the second step says that best when it says came to believe. That a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Now, in my arrogance, of course, I couldn't see any insanity in what was going on. And another one of the elders suggested that with whatever honesty you're capable of summoning today, and he took the time and the patience to explain that, that most of us, when we arrive up here, a lot of us think we're cash register honest, what's the big deal? And there's so much more to honesty, self-honesty than that. And that grows on a daily, an hourly, a minute-to-minute basis. That ability to be more honest grows if we work at it. And so he said, with whatever honesty you're capable of summoning today, look at your life and can you see any insanity? Well, I didn't have to look very far, and there was lots of it, lots of it. I'll just explain my drunkalogue this way. I worked for this company for 36 years in 1993. With 24 years sobriety, I retired, and I got a roast. There were 14 speakers. 12 of the speakers, after 23 years, told drunk stories about things that I had done. The 13th speaker was a guy that worked for me, and I had 12-stepped him. And the 14th speaker was a friend that lived in the city where this event took place. So, in the third step, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over the care of God as we understand them or don't understand them or misunderstand them. One of the elders said, early days, he said two things that stuck. And one of them was, treat the unknown as friendly. Always treat the unknown as friendly instead of in a negative way. And the other thing that he said he did, and I've done most days since then, is that every morning write down today's date in the third step and date it and sign it. It takes 30 or 35 seconds to do that. I do that on my knees. Today, June 30th or July 1, 2005, I turn my life and my will totally and completely over the care of God as I understand them. And some days I write as I don't understand them. But it's an action. It's an action program, and it's a piece of action. And when I do that, the days seem to go smoother. The speed bumps aren't so bumpy. And when I don't do it, the speed bumps are a little more bumpy. It doesn't mean I'm on my way to a drink or anything like it, but it means that it's very, very helpful to me and very comforting, and it works. Fourth step. What I did with the fourth step is they were after me right away, and I came in April, so one day, and I don't remember exactly, but June or July, we lived on the North Shore of Long Island, and I had a boat at the time, and we had a kind of a favorite swimming hole that we went to with the kids and so forth. And so Sunday morning, I got the big book and a pad of paper and a pen and some sandwiches, and I got on my boat, and I went and anchored at one of these holes and started to work. And if it got too hot, I'd jump in the water and swim for a while and then come back and work some more. And if I wanted to go to the Sunday night meeting, because I was supposed to make the coffee, don't you know? And so I got off the boat about 6 o'clock. But here's what happened. What happened was when I was finished with that work, I found a broad horizon of opportunity for personal growth. And it was wonderful. It was very cathartic. It really helped me a lot. Since then, I have done an annual four-step because I think it's, for me at least, four-step is always a work in progress, never finished. And in addition to that, I also use it whenever there's chaos in my life, with whatever honesty I'm capable of summoning, I have made some contribution. And that's often not defined. And so when I put it in writing, it develops clarity. And I can see, and it's very helpful. So when I get chaos, I will do a very narrow fourth step just having to do with the chaos. And I find that tremendously helpful. The fifth step was great. And I still do that, again, with another human being and the God of my misunderstanding. And I find all of this works for me. And there was a lot of conversation about 6 and 7 in another meeting I was in earlier today. And it's really, I found it, again, coming back to the honesty part, I came to a place where I had to describe the honesty. The big book describes it as rigorous. For my purposes, I have to say rigorous and ruthless self-honesty, because we've got to really get down to it. There were some certain character defects that I wasn't exactly, you know, rushing in to get rid of, but I worked hard at getting an attitude for that to happen. but there were some other character defects that I didn't know about or couldn't see. One of them was a major control issue, which I absolutely positively could not see at all. And to me, then as today, controlling behavior is very abhorrent. And I was 7 years sober. This group that I went into, the loving people that they are, they gave everybody a nickname. Okay? Mine was cruise director. It took me 7 years to figure out that was not a compliment. So some people started talking to me about my control issues, and I said, well, give me an example. Like he said earlier, some people want to know how you turn it over. Well, give me an example. And I couldn't understand it. I absolutely, positively couldn't understand it. But the main thing is that I was willing. I wasn't trying to duck the issue. And so I was going with a gal at the time, and we ultimately married, and we did a lot of, went to meetings with another couple, and they were both in the program. And in that couple, she was the controlling person, and he was the soft-spoken and artistic and so forth. And in many respects, Kathy had the same characteristics as he did. So Kathy would tell me about, when I would ask, these control issues, which I absolutely, positively couldn't understand. Leela was having the same problem with Jim. And so we would talk about this, and this went on for some months. And so one Wednesday night, we went to the meeting, come home from the meeting, I go over to Kathy's house, Jim goes over to Leela's house, and about 10:30, the phone rings, and it's Leela, and she said, I've got it, I understand, I finally understand it. So I'll be right over, I jump in the car, I go over. I said, Jim, tell me. The fascinating part of this story is that not only did he use exactly the same vocabulary that Kathy'd been using, but the same intonations and everything. It was like a tape recording. And I heard it. And when I heard it and saw the vast dimension of this thing, I had a whole bunch of amends to make, not the least of which was to family and kids and all that sort of thing. So that was my experience with both six. Seven gave me real, humbly, yes, that's a great start, okay. That gave me what I mentioned earlier about the understanding of what it is that I can do by myself and what it is I need some outside power. And the eighth step, the key word there for me is willing. And I don't know what your experience is, but I didn't remember everything on the first day or the first week or the first month. And as it goes on, I remember things. And so after some years, and I don't remember how long, I remembered an incident. I was now living in New York, but I had grown up in Detroit and had done a lot of serious drinking there and so forth. And it occurred to me, I remembered one morning in the shower, an incident. If the incident and memory was anywhere near accurate, I had done some serious damage and by saying something that was out of order, and I needed to go and fix that. At the time of this discovery, I lived near LaGuardia Airport and traveled all the time, virtually every week. And my parents were living in Detroit, and so I would frequently wind up in Chicago or St. Louis or something, and then stop in Detroit on the way home. So I made a decision, because I had a large family, I made a decision I was going to Detroit was where this thing may have happened. So I go, and I get a rent-a-car there, and I spend about an hour looking in phone books and so forth, and go see my folks and get on an airplane and go home. Very dissatisfied with the results of my efforts, or lack of efforts. So a couple weeks later, I went back and did the same thing, but a little more extensively, but nowhere near full effort, and with the same results. Felt lousy about it. And so finally, one day, I decided to go there on a Thursday night, and I wasn't going to tell anybody I was in town. Nobody would know that I was there, and I was going to do some very thorough research, and I did, and started tracing addresses from one small town to another, to the next leg, and so on. And in the middle of the afternoon, I ran out of cigarettes, and I was in this little four-corner store, where this person that I was looking for was alleged to be living, and I went into the drugstore to buy a pack of cigarettes, and I said to the pharmacist, by the way, do you know so-and-so? And he said, oh, yeah, Florence was just here a little while ago getting medicine for one of the kids. So he gave me the address, and I drove over to the house, and she was out in the yard fixing, fussing with the flowers, and I drove by. And I made a U-turn, and I drove by, and did that several times because I was really scared and fearful. And finally, I pulled in the driveway, and I hadn't seen her for a number of years, and she jumped out of the car, came to cry. came over and gave me a big hug, and I told her why the purpose of my visit really had to do with her husband. And she said, well, Dick's going to be back in 15 or 20 minutes, and he did, and he and I went out on the porch, and we had our conversation. As it turned out, the incident was not as I had imagined or thought or remembered. But the big message there was the payoff reinstituted a relationship with a non-alcoholic friend where we had been good friends earlier years, and that still exists to this day. That's the oldest of three siblings. My behavior as a teenager was awful, just awful. And obviously it involved booze, too. And my parents, at what I came later to understand, at very substantial emotional and financial sacrifice, elected to send me to high school at a Jesuit boarding school that was 1,000 miles from home. And that was the most wonderful thing that ever could have happened to me, because it literally saved my life. So I come out, and I screw up lots and lots of things, get married, divorced, kids, on and on and on and on and on. Finally, I wind up here. And now I'm 30-some-odd years sober, a couple years ago. And it dawned on me that during those teenage years, my parents had to put so much energy into dealing with my shenanigans, emotional energy, financial energy, and so forth, that my siblings got shortchanged. And so I sat down, and we were coming up. There was going to be a family reunion like in 2 weeks when this dawned on me. And I was thrilled. I called each of them and asked them. I said, and all the kids and grandkids, everybody's going to be there. I said, I need 15 to 20 minutes aside with you guys. And something happened. I couldn't go. So I wrote a letter of amends and sent it off to both of them. And you can imagine, what a wonderful thing it was. So this is all, whole thing is really a work in progress. We're really not finished yet. Okay? Wait for the next breath, the next breath. And most of all, don't leave before the miracle happens. 10th step, immediately, not later, right now. And sometimes the arrogance of an alcoholic has difficulty admitting when he or she is wrong. But the payoff, again, is stupendous if you're willing to do it. And it doesn't take very much effort. And the payoff is humongous. In the 11th step, sought through prayer and meditation to learn what the will of God for us, and seek power, and we get it. Seek power. Start out powerless. The ticket into this party is to admit powerlessness. And when we get to 11, we seek power and we get it in incredible dimensions, unbelievable dimensions. And I would like to ask you in a few minutes when we close to offer a prayer for a woman that may or may not be here who a couple of years ago dealt with serious cancer and successful chemo. Is now back on chemo, and her name is Barbara, and she's sober 3 weeks longer than I am, and she never fails to remind me of that. But she needs our help, okay? And the 12th step, of course, is I never had a burning bush, but to me, the spiritual awakening is this growth, this continuing change that I've been talking about. In the spirit inside of us, to come to realize that that's really what the spirit is inside of us. Me, that's what I figured out. And of course, the most important thing is practice these principles in all of our affairs. One sage said, if you can't practice your principle in all your affairs, you've got too many affairs. And then carry the message. You're all carrying the message today by being here. You're carrying it even to the people at home who wished you bon voyage when you came here. And over the coming next 2 days. And is there anybody here for their first international? Wow. You ain't seen nothing yet. I beg you to, no matter what, go tonight to the flag ceremony. And there are four new... I was in Seattle when Russia came for the first time. That's an incredible moving thing. Tonight, there will be four new first-timers. China, Cuba, Mongolia, and Qatar. Fantastic, huh? when those guys or gals walk down the hall, down the aisleway with those flags, you are doing 12-step work for them. And they will take that back home to wherever they are. So all of this is a process. It's an ongoing journey, not a destination. And I sum up all of this in 5 points. Well, number one, look to the sun. In other words, look at life with positive expectation rather than negative expectation. The tools are available at hand to do that. So look to the sun. Secondly, come laugh with us. We all laughed with Leslie, not at her. God love her. We all laughed with her. There's a man here in the first row with a T-shirt on that says, if you want to give God a laugh, call him up and tell him your plans for today. Okay? So if you travel at all and go to a strange meeting and you can't quite find the meeting, all you have to do is stand still for a minute and listen to the laughter, because that's where we are. So come laugh with us. Okay, look to the sun, come laugh with us. Don't drink. Even if your ass falls off, and if it does, pick it up and take it to a meeting. So the next one is go to meetings. And in time, you will see things differently. If we don't change the bum that brought us in, that bum's going to take us back out. All of the things that we think made us thirsty enough to get here, whether that's financial or marital or social or whatever the hell, those things basically don't change. We have to change and learn how to live life on life's terms. So in time, we will see things differently. Look to the sun, come laugh with us, don't drink, go to meetings, and in time, you'll see things differently. Thank you very much for my support.
So if you're new and you turn it over and work these steps, now you know. You get a car, a house, a job with an expense account, medical insurance, and the sailboat. Next, we have Special Ed from Webb City, Missouri.
My name is Special Ed, and I am an alcoholic. In case you may be offended by that term, I believe that I'm in God's special education program. On the way here from the GO train, a guy came by from New Jersey, saw my tag. He says, Special Ed, we call that crack where I come from. How much time I got? I'm well aware of the need to turn it over because I've been experiencing lately some wonderful opportunities to do that. In this, my 31st year of sobriety, I've gone through probably some of the most pain that I've had in the whole time. I don't know if it is the most or not. It seems like it because that's what I'm going through in the present time. And so I've had to continue to turn it over. And my inability to do that, my reluctance to do that, is always causing what one of my friends calls, I am an architect of chaos. Now, just recently, I did a third step, and I said, God, I'm going to give it all to you again. I'm going to come to you, Father. I did this in the presence of another member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I said, I'm going to give it all to you again. I'm going to give you all the past, all my ideas about what I think my life should be, and everything that I think is going to become, and I'm going to give it all to you again. I'm going to do this third step again. In less than 5 minutes, I heard myself saying what I'm going to do and what I'm not going to do in the future. My problem has absolutely nothing to do with drinking. My problem has to do with what the big book calls self-will run riot. Now, all of my life, I believe that to compensate for this inordinate fear that I seem to have inside me, that I had to do things to prove I wasn't afraid, and I became self-will run riot. And through school, I was self-will run riot. I can't tell you when I had my first drink, by the way, so I don't spend much time talking about that. I used to say that I started drinking when I was 15. What really happened was I started blackout drinking at 15. After I'd been sober about 10 years, and my mother heard me say that I started drinking at 15, she says, no, Ed, the first time I remember you being drunk, you were 18 months old at a party, and you were going around emptying all the glasses. You got so drunk, you fell down and couldn't get up. So I really don't know when my first drink was. Conversely, I don't know when my last one was either. I claim November 9th, 1973 as my sobriety date because that's the day I was led by the hand into a treatment center, United States Naval Hospital, Long Beach, California. And I had become totally non-functional through the abuse of alcohol and through the way I've been living my life on self-will. Now, that self-will, that not wanting anybody to tell me what to do, at age 17, I tried it when I was 15, but they caught me. At age 17, I joined the United States Marine Corps because that's where you go when you don't want people to tell you what to do, right? That will tell you a lot about my reasoning skills. They haven't improved much. Marine Corps made a big bad mistake. They started allowing me to tell people what to do. I liked that so much I made a career of it. In my arrogance, in my ignorance, in Vietnam, my battalion chaplain, who was a young Irish Catholic chaplain, saw my name tag on my jacket, and he says, "Croghan, you're Irish, aren't you?" I said, "Yes, Father." He says, "Well, you're Catholic then, aren't you?" I said, "No, Father." He said, "Well, what are you?" I said, "You read the name tag. I'm a Croghan." He says, "I know that, smart ass, but what do you believe in?" I said, "That's what I believe in." He says, "Well, how does that work?" I said, "It works fine. If I do a good job, I say, 'Good job, Croghan.' If I do a bad job, I say, 'Bad job, Croghan.'" I know a lot about willpower. In that 20 years, I held 14 ranks. If you know anything, none of those were reductions. They were all promotions. If you know anything about the Marine Corps' promotion system, you know that that's kind of unusual. Of course, there was a war to help that along. But I was applying my will. I was applying my will very forcefully in my life. I was applying my will very forcefully in everybody else's life under me. And I was demanding perfection. On one of my semi-annual fitness reports in the remarks section, my commanding officer wrote, "This man demands perfection of all of his subordinates, but he also demands it of himself." And I thought that that was a wonderful, wonderful testimony to my leadership ability. I come into Alcoholics Anonymous and they tell me it's a character defect. The program of Alcoholics Anonymous asked me to go totally against my nature. I heard Chuck C. come down to Camp Pendleton and talk to the NCOs and officers of the 5th Marine Division. This was in my early sobriety. And I wanted to go over and hear Chuck, because I'd heard Chuck a couple times, and I was always moved by the spiritual nature of his talks. And I wanted to go over and see how these Marines responded to that, you know. I was still on active duty, hadn't retired yet. And Chuck got up there at the podium, and he looked out at that audience with that loving look that he had, paused for a long time, and started giggling. He says, "They've asked me to come down here from Laguna Beach to talk to you Marines about something you know absolutely nothing about." That hooked all their egos. I mean, they're all bemetaled with more than covered their chests, you know. Hooked all their egos, got all their attention, and he said, "Surrender." I've given lots of classes on how to avoid surrender. I've given lots of classes how it's unacceptable to surrender. I come into Alcoholics Anonymous and they tell me, "Surrender." We quit fighting everything and everybody. How do you do that? I don't know how to do that. I fight everything and everybody. My first 5 years of sobriety, the most loving thing that I could do when some man directly confronted me face to face was just not hit him. That was the extent of love. Don't hit him. Make yourself sit down. Sit down, they said. Sit on your hands, you know. Don't hit them. You know, there's a lot of newcomers and old-timers, too, that will deliberately provoke you in this organization. Right? I walked into the Alano Club in Riverside, California, in my early sobriety, and two guys were in the front of this kind of storefront building that they had, and they were having an altercation, and one of them threw the other one out through the plate glass window, and I said, "I understand this kind of behavior, you know." They tell me, "Surrender." 5 years, most loving thing I could do, was just not getting the physical altercation, you know. And then, after I stopped doing that, I watched this thing in my brain that says, yeah, but. Yeah, but. What if? Now, any time that I'm considering surrender, any time I'm considering turning it over, any time somebody's confronting me with one of my character defects, that thing goes, yeah, but. What if? I watched that in meetings. I watched myself sitting in meetings, can't wait till somebody gets done talking so I can editorialize their comments. Huh? I found out this is called abusive behavior. So I knew absolutely nothing about what this program is about. And the only way that I became willing was through what it says in the last paragraph of the first step, in the 12 and 12. Driven under the lash of alcoholism. Now, I had been to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I went with my friend John. Now, John was one of those alcoholics that he was one of the few that whenever he was in a bar drunk and crazy, I'd kind of tone down my act a little bit because John was one of those crazy drunks that you got to kill him to stop him. You know? John had half his ear bitten off in the NCO club down at Camp Lejeune one time, almost killed the guy, bit his ear off. John just didn't stop, you know. So I see John and he's 10 months sober. I had him over to the house. I offered him a beer. He didn't drink one. And John told me some very strange things. John told me about this program of love. Surrender. Acceptance. I popped a top on a beer and slid it across the table to him. He wouldn't take it. He says, I don't do that anymore. I'm in this program of recovery. So he left and my wife says, what do you think about that? And I said, boy, something's happened to John. And I'm glad something's happened to John because John needed something really bad. So. John's crazy. Of course, John was one of my drinking buddies, right? So I started thinking about that. You know how they talk about the seed being planted? I started thinking about that. A couple of days I called John up and I said, John, I think I have a problem with alcohol. And he said, well, I've been waiting for you to call. Why would he be waiting for me to call? How did he know I had a problem with alcohol? So we made a date to go to one of them AA meetings. And I had to have a few drinks to think about it. And I called him up about 45 minutes before the meeting was to start. And I said, John, I got unexpected company. It came to the house. I'm not going to be able to make that AA meeting. He says, you're lying, Ed, but it's okay. What a terrible thing to say to me. A couple more days went by, and I felt remorseful that I'd stood John up. After all, he's a good friend of mine, had been for many years. So I called him back and said, okay, let's go to one of those meetings. So he took me to a meeting in a little Alano club in Oceanside, California. There, I had some of the most despicable things done to me that I ever had done in my life. They looked at me funny. Like you're looking at me right now. You know that look when they look inside you? You know, I had seen that look before, one time on the eyes of a clergyman, another time on the eyes of a psychiatrist that I went to. I didn't want anybody to look inside. Here's a haunted house in here. I don't want you seeing in there. And then they did one of the most terrible, terrible things that had ever happened to me. At the end of the meeting, they held hands and prayed. Whew. I wanted out of there. I was drenched in perspiration. Yeah. John takes me over to the literature rack, and he gets all of the pamphlets, and he's compulsive, too. You know, he gave me one of each. All but a whole stack. I walk over, open the pantry door, throw them on a trash can. My wife says, how'd you like that AA meeting? I says, good for those people. It's not what I need. I made a decision. I'll never come back to you people again. I like to tell you this. Not my fault that I'm here, see? I made a decision. I made a decision not to be here. Things got real bad, however, and under the lash of alcoholism, my command forced me into treatment. And they took me up to this naval hospital in Long Beach and on the alcohol ward there, and I walked in there and I saw another despicable sight. I saw a Marine staff sergeant in uniform hugging a Navy chief in uniform. I thought to myself, I wonder if the Commandant of the Marine Corps knows what's going on here. Somebody's got to put a stop to this stuff. It's going to have to be me. It always is. But they told me I was going to die of alcoholism if I didn't get this program. And by then I believed them. See, I came very close not only to dying of the chemical effects of alcohol. I came very close, who knows how many times in the violent life that I live. But I came very close to my last drunk because I was terrorizing the house, tearing it up, and scaring everybody, punching holes in the wall and all that. You know, and my second oldest son loaded up his rifle that I gave him for Christmas with a full magazine, positioned himself in his bedroom, made the decision if I came in that room, he was going to put a whole magazine at my chest. Okay. We have a wonderful relationship now, by the way. I don't provoke him. So I knew there was something inside me, you know, that the feeling of impending doom that they talk about, there was something inside me, and I don't call it fear because fear doesn't quite describe it. I had a spiritual terror inside me. And when they talked about a spiritual program and God, I said, I am now in big trouble. If this thing is about God, I am in trouble because I had done everything that I was told God didn't want me to do. I didn't miss anything. Take my word for it. You know? This is no half-stepping heathen you got up here. If what Pastor Baser told me in catechism class was true, I was going to hell and I was going for cause. It was not going to be a bum rap. Because he had told me back there when I was 15 years old, you know, to think about it was the same as doing it. I said, if I'm going to hell for thinking about it, I'm going for doing it. I ridiculed the clergy. I'd go in an officer's club, you know, and there'd be young chaplains sitting there. And I'd tell them to stay away from my troops. I didn't want them corrupting my troops with that superstitious nonsense. And I'd proceed to tell them how foolish they were for believing it. And I'd like to get them drunk if I could, you know. I want to get them to my level. So I had a, what you might call, anti-religious attitude. I think the big book talked about that somewhere. It says some of us have been violently anti-religious. I was violently anti-religious. I was violently anti-anything. You know. So they tell me I got to get right with God. I got to work this program, and I got to have a spiritual awakening. So I said about, I don't want to die of alcoholism. I don't want to get any crazier than I already am. I'm about to lose my career. I was within 6 months of retiring, and all this that I dedicated myself to was going out the window. You know, wife and kids were gone. So I set about working these 12 steps, and something happened to me very early in sobriety. I did have a burning bush experience. I did have one of those overwhelming, consuming what the church calls baptism of the Holy Spirit, where the power of God came on me with such totality and such immensity and such thoroughness that I knew that I was in the presence of God. And nobody could have described that to me. Nobody could have told me what that was like. I tried later to describe it to other people, and if it hasn't happened to you, you just don't know what it's like. No. But that happened to me. Now I was excited. Now I found out that this God was real. Not only was he real, but I'd never felt such love and such peace and such forgiveness in my life. And boy, I was excited. Now, I'd like to be able to tell you that from that point until now, it has been easy, but I still have that personality in there that doesn't like anybody telling them what to do. I still have that rebelliousness inside me that, you know, I come from the Missouri state. They call it the Show Me State, you know. That fits me real well. I didn't grow up there, but that fits me real well. I test all things to know that they are true. I do. I check them out. I mean, if you tell me something about spiritual or supernatural things, I want to know about it. I test them. I check them out. I want to see how it applies in my life. Because that's what they taught me to do in Alcoholics Anonymous. when they'd ask me about something, and I'd give them some intellectual crap about it, they'd say, well, where are you with that, Ed? Where are you with that? And they'd challenge me on those things, and they'd confront you on those things. I had to find out where I was with all of these things. Well, the change that God has made in my life is what I do now is I'm one of the pastors of a church in Webb City, Missouri. You're enjoying that too much. That'll tell you who my higher power is. I do confess him by name. I am one of those ones in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous that some of our more religious members come to love him and call him by name. And I call Jesus by name. That's my higher power. I know it doesn't have to be yours, but I'm saying it for me. Alcoholics Anonymous opened the door to a spiritual realm that I didn't know existed. It opened the door to the possibility of me not only being forgiven of all that that I'd done in my past, but to be able to help other people get free also. One of the big regrets that I have about early sobriety and much of my sobriety is I have taken the 12 steps and beat myself and other people with them. I took all my character defects and applied it to the program. And I called it working my program. And if you didn't like it, you had a problem with your programs. Yeah. And the Lord confronted me one day. I was out raking leaves. You can't get too intellectual when you're raking leaves, you know. He says, Edward, I always know when it's him because he called me Edward. You know. Yeah. That's right. He just said children's respect. That's true. He treats me with dignity. That's true. He said, you know how you tell everybody you're working your program? I said, yes, Lord. He said, that's what you're doing. You're not working mine. He says things like that to me through you people, too. This disturbance that I've gone through in this year of sobriety has been over one of those things we call relationships. I had stayed out of them for 24 years because I didn't want another bad one. So I met this gal in the program, a 13-step to newcomer. She only had 20 years of sobriety. She made me promise not to tell you her name. And I violated that thing in the 12 and 12 and the 12 step where it says prospective partners need to know each other long enough, well enough to be certain that they're compatible spiritually, mentally, physically, and that's real, not wishful thinking. It wasn't real. I had a lot of wishful thinking going on. After 3 months, she told me she didn't want to do that anymore. And boy, I was really hurt. And I called one of my early sponsors, a guy I did my third step with. He's up in New York. He's 35 years sober. I inadvertently, last week, ran into her in a restaurant parking lot. And I was filled with pain. And I called Lou on the phone, and I said, it's not going too good today. He said, well, what's the matter, Ed? What's going on? I said, I had a lot of pain. He says, now, Lou not only has 35 years of sobriety, he's got a master's degree in counseling. You know, it's no lightweight I'm dealing with here. He says, what's the pain about, Ed? And I says, well, I ran into her. I almost said her name. I ran into her in the parking lot, and I felt all this pain. And he says, well, what was the pain about? And I said, she doesn't seem to be hurting over this like I am. Oh, God. He says, where's the love in that, Ed? Where's that? Where's the love in wanting another human being to hurt? I said, yeah, Lou. Yeah, but, right? Yeah. Yeah, Lou, I'm angry. He says, what are you angry about? And I says, I kept this commitment. She didn't want to keep this commitment. He says, commitment? What you wanted to do was take a hostage. He said, why don't you just enjoy the good times you had together? I said, well, I did. I wanted more of them. He says, oh, in other words, you wanted to manipulate and control the future. That's what these old timers and Alcoholics Anonymous do. You know, they confront your stuff. You know. So that's what they call karma, I guess, because that's what I do to other people in the program. You know, I don't have much compassion with them when they're suffering. You know, I make them look at their stuff and, you know. You know, what is your part in this? Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous told me that any time that I take an action based on self-centered fear, I set in motion another set of circumstances that is guaranteed to come back and hurt me. I want to blame it on somebody else. I want to blame it on her. And I want to glorify this grieving that I've been doing, see? And then I come to realize by inventorying this whole thing and how I set it in motion and all that, you know, I realize that this grieving that I'm talking about is really resentment. I don't want to admit that it's resentment. I'm not supposed to have resentment. So I did what our brother over here said. You know, I had to begin to start praying for her. Begin asking God to give her everything that I want in my life. That's the only way I got relief. That's the only way I get any relief. I can go and I can talk it to death with other people, and I do and have, so much so. I'm sick of hearing me talk about it. Don't you hate it when I say, just let it go? I'd like to let it go. So anyhow, people in Alcoholics Anonymous have been doing that to me or for me ever since I've been in the program. Pray to God and never quit. Something always brings my problems into proper perspective. Before we came over here today, we got a phone call that a man with 49 years of sobriety, his wife just passed away last night. It puts my stuff in proper perspective. We have a gal down here in my home area that three of her children were killed one time with a train. She stayed clean and sober. When she walks into a meeting, people who know her, she doesn't have to say a word. She carries a powerful message, just that she stayed clean and sober through probably one of the most painful things a mother could experience. You people, by sharing your pain with me, you people, by being honest about yourself, you people, by telling me that what has happened with you in your life has been allowed me to be able to see myself better, because I don't see myself well at all. I have this idealized concept of who I am, and I'm not that. You know, I'd like to be able to say to you newcomers, you can be 31 years sober and everything is peaches and cream, but that's not the way it's been. The way it's been for 31 years is there have been a lot of painful experiences. I had to experience things like both my parents died. Got blessed with the fact I got to conduct both of their services. You know how I conducted their services? By the way, you people in Alcoholics Anonymous showed me how to conduct a service. That's where I learned how to do that. All the things that have happened, all the pains, all what we call human tragedies that have happened to me in 31 years, God has given me the grace and the power and the ability to go through it, and He's used you. So when I say I'm not here because it's my fault, I'm also not here to my credit. And I found out that this thing about anonymity, that's really what it's talking about. If I'm really anonymous and stay anonymous with God, I'm not seeking credit, nor am I seeking blame. Big Book says we get out of balance both ways. We get out as a power driver or a depressive. I'm only a depressive when my power drive fails. That's when I'm depressive. I'll tell you one last thing about why it's not my fault I'm here. Last year sometime, I was sniveling to God. I have prayer and sniveling confused. I said, Lord, consider your servant. I got that out of Proverbs or something. Yeah. Here I am, over 30 years sober, they haven't asked me to speak at a convention yet. What's this all about? 2 months later, the invitation came to come and share with you at this convention. So that's what to say. Be careful what you pray for. I consider it a blessing. I consider it an honor. I consider it a great privilege to be able to share with you. I asked God in the beginning, I said, if you will give me one more year of life, I will do my best to try to clean up some of this mess. Be grateful He didn't give me what I asked for. Huh? He knew it was going to take a lot longer than 1 year. I was in a meeting out in California 2 years ago, and I watched Manny from L.A. taking a medallion for 52 years. 52 years. Manny still goes to meetings every day. Manny still is full of love. Manny still reaches out to newcomers. Manny still is doing all the things that they told me to do when I got here. Yeah. And I said, there's my long-term goal. I want that L on a medallion. I want to do it one day at a time. But I want an L on that medallion. And I believe with God it's possible. I believe with God all things are possible. I believe if I continue to work this program, that I can say and will be doing what Chuck C. told me in the very beginning. I'll be doing this till they pat me in the face with a scoop. This guy I was talking to up in New York, he also told me something else. He said, Ed, before you go in there and talk, stop over at Walmart and get an ego peeler. Thank you.
Thank you, Ed. We may have a couple of minutes here for a couple of questions or comments, if anyone has one, before we close. Keep in mind, I believe that's Ed's son sitting outside the back door. There are none. I would like to thank our speakers for this afternoon's session. Thank you very much for sharing your experience. Thank you. In closing, let me say that one of the best examples of turning over something you love happened 50 years ago this weekend in St. Louis, Missouri, on behalf of Dr. Bob and the old timers. Bill Wilson turned this fellowship over to us to guard and protect and keep it the way it was, to turn it over to the next generation. So in closing, we'll close this meeting the way they did back then, with the Lord's Prayer. And if you would, remember Henry's friend Barbara while you're saying this. Our Father,
who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name, thy kingdom come.